Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Politics and Prose. My name is Shane Cagney. I'm one of the booksellers here at the store. When Mark Ozer writes history books about Washington, D.C., he seems to have two types of books. The first type is exemplified by the titles Northwest Washington, D.C. and Massachusetts Avenue in the Gilded Age. In these, Mark is a perfect city guide to some of the most storied thoroughfares of Washington, describing how neighborhoods were planned and how they evolved, the contemporary political situation, pointing out prominent buildings and describing the often exceptional individuals who lived in them. The second type of book has a wider focus, and they all start with the word Washington. They explore the city's history, whether it is the landscape upon which the city rests, such as in Politics and Place, or the effects of the War of 1812, when the city was very briefly captured by the British. Recently, Mark wrote a very lively history of the Metrorail system, which is the second largest in the nation. These books have a unique structure, which you can read the work straight through in a conventional fashion, or alternatively, you can dip into them just about anywhere and be rewarded. Another aspect that strikes me is that Mark is not afraid to expose the reader to a level of detail that is not readily available elsewhere. These books are unique. They offer a richer experience than any guidebook for anyone visiting the city and are a handy reference for long-term inhabitants who are either hosting visitors or who just want to discover more about the extraordinary events, buildings, and statues that dot the landscape. In his latest book, Washington, D.C. and the Civil War, Mark describes the importance of the city before, during, and as a symbol after the war. And I think it's one of his best. Please join me in welcoming Mark Ozer.
Thank you, Shane. It's always good to come home again to Politics and Prose and to see some of our old friends and new friends. And I'm happy to be here, and I'm joined by some of my own family, my grandson, two of my grandsons. Where are they? Here they are. And my son and my daughter. We're having a family reunion, and I thought it'd be nice to have us all together to hear about a new book. As you know, as Shane, who's an old friend, has said, I write books about Washington. I write books about what I'm interested in because I think of what I might be interested in, others may be as well. And so I like to dig a little deeper than most guidebooks or most people. Hi there, Ellie. I like to dig a little deeper in terms of the things that might interest me, might interest others. I've been interested in the Civil War because when I moved here, I didn't know anything about the war. I mean, as you know, the city was one of the issues in the war. Battles were fought back and forth every year. I had trouble remembering the generals. Each year was a different general. I had trouble remembering what right flank did and left flank did. And so I had to write some books about it in order to figure out what was going on. And I've tried to give a little broader perspective than just the battles. I tried to give some perspective on what went on that would make sense to people who are thinking about why this was an important portion of the battle and of the wars and how these wars continue to be fought. When I looked at the issues, I wanted to think about how Washington had different roles. The first role, of course, which was its ancient role, was to be the seat of government. And that was the title before George Washington. He never called it Washington, D.C. He was too, we thought it would be too grandiose to call a city after himself. So it was called the seat of government. And it was as a seat of government, of course, during the Civil War, a lot happened in the political life of the country. Most important, of course, the executive. The centralization that occurs during wartime was a very, very big change in the character of the central government. And during the course of the war, it's said that Washington, that the United States of America ceased to be a plural noun and became a singular noun. And this became a nation state. And this capital was a very important thing that changed because it had become a more centralized government. As you know, the executive became more powerful. But most importantly, the legislature changed its character. With the withdrawal of the states' rights representatives and senators, the legislature and the executive was free to do all kinds of things that they had not been able to do until then. And most importantly, they established a national currency, a national bank. And in the long run, the most important thing they did was establish a transcontinental railroad that very importantly did not go through the South. It went through the middle of the country because the South was not represented in the legislature. So a lot of things happened because from a political point of view in the halls of Congress and therefore in the Washington, D.C. But I was interested in how in all my books, I'm interested in how Washington itself, as a place, has affected history and has been affected by history. And Washington was not only a seat of government, it was a seat of war. It was an important objective for the Confederacy, and its protection was an important aim for the Army of the Potomac. And indeed, a lot of the offensive strategy that Robert E. Lee carried out was designed to deal with perhaps the Army of the Potomac being drawn into battle and the Army of Northern Virginia invaded in Antietam and again in Gettysburg. And that was the offensive strategy because defensive forts had been built around Washington, and in order to capture Washington, which was an important objective, he had to draw the Army of the Potomac away from Washington, and therefore perhaps defeat it. And he nearly did defeat it, again in Antietam and at Gettysburg. And eventually, of course, Jubal Early actually attacked the defensive forts in July of 64 and the famous Battle of Fort Stevens. So it was a seat of war, and it was also became a supply center, became a medical center, and a lot of other things for the Army of the Potomac when it in turn had its role to capture Richmond and also, of course, to defeat the Army of Northern Virginia. So it had an important role during the war. It had an important role as a reflection of the change in the character of the federal government. But I think its most important role is what its continuing role has been as a site of Civil War memory. Now, when we think about what the Civil War has meant in American history, there are two narratives. One is the narrative of military victory, of the Union reunion, of maintenance of the Union, and the other is that of emancipation. There are two narratives to the Civil War. And what we have seen on the streets of Washington is mostly one narrative, the narrative of military victory. We see all these statues of all these men on horseback. Every little square, every little triangle has its own military hero. And what it has done is created the story of the Civil War as being a military action. And a lot of people are very interested in that. A lot of these reenactors go and fight the battles. But what that has done is it has submerged the history of the other narrative, which is that of emancipation. And so let's look at what the story is as it is written and as continues to be written on the streets of Washington. Because the military victory, if that's the entire story, was resolved in the generation that followed into reconciliation. And when you look at how the Civil War is commemorated in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol, which reflects the history of the United States. The only thing that reflects the history of the Civil War is that of the blue and gray shaking hands. Now, what does that mean? It means that there was reconciliation between the blue and the gray. There was reconciliation which united on the basis of common valor and common sacrifice. And that became the story of the Civil War. The story of military victory did not recognize the existence of emancipation as one of the narratives. And this started with the Grand Review. The Grand Review in May of 1865 was described by Walt Whitman. As you know, he was living here. And he describes it in his own vivid way. He says, "For 2 days now, the broad spaces of Pennsylvania Avenue along to the Treasury Hill have been alive with a magnificent sight, the returning armies. In their wide ranks stretching clear across the avenue, I watch them march or ride along. Through 2 whole days, infantry, cavalry, artillery, some 200,000 men." Nowhere were there any of the colored troops and their officers. They were not there. And there was a portent of the degree to which there would be lack of recognition of any role of colored troops in creating emancipation or creating the victory. Only at the celebration of the unveiling of the African American Civil War Memorial in September 1996, 300 blacks in Civil War Union uniforms marched down Pennsylvania Avenue in a reenactment of that 1865 Grand Review from which their ancestors had been excluded. And the film Glory that we know about in early 1990s brought attention to the Battle of Fort Wagner and Charleston Harbor in 1863, in which Robert Gould Shaw and his colored 54th Massachusetts Regiment incurred the heavy losses. It's interesting that that monument is in the Shaw District. As you know, the Shaw District took its name from Robert Gould Shaw Junior High School, actually coincidental to the fact that Robert Gould Shaw was the colonel in charge of this 54th Okay, this is a 10th. Anyone of you been there? 10th and L at New Street. There's a subway stop, metro stop right next door. Okay, Robert Gould Shaw. List the names of the men involved in the Civil War. So, as I said, the only official recognition of the Civil War in the frieze of the rotunda is one that does not recognize emancipation to have existed. It's only reunion, reconciliation between the North and the South. However, Montgomery Meigs, whom you may know was the guy who designed the Federal Pension Bureau, which was the biggest building in Washington, that reflects how important the pensions were in the political life of the post-Civil War generation. At any rate, Montgomery Meigs was an extraordinary character, and he had this image of building a frieze around the Federal Pension Bureau building because he thought of it as, you know, the frieze that goes around the Parthenon. He had these grand ideas of how Washington should reflect classical architecture. Anyway, he insisted that the frieze on the west section of the Federal Bureau reflect the appearance of the African-American men who worked for him in the Quartermaster Corps. As you know, men who freed themselves walked to the Union lines and were recruited to work as teamsters and laborers and so forth. So these were men who worked as teamsters for the Quartermaster Corps. And he insisted that they be recognized for what they were. And that's the only official recognition of the men who had done what they could to support the Union forces. So from a military point of view, there's very little recognition. Now, we all know the Statue of Emancipation in Lincoln Square, or Lincoln, whatever it's called. It's called Lincoln Square. And that is, of course, a flawed recognition, because what it shows is Lincoln standing up and a man sort of freeing himself, but actually in a subordinate position. So it doesn't reflect any of these people who actually walked to free themselves. It sort of seems to reflect the fact that emancipation was conferred rather than achieved in some way. So it is flawed. So we have all these other statues. We have all these other memorials. Of course, the most important one is the Lincoln Memorial. And what does the Lincoln Memorial reflect? In the 1890s, William McKinley was elected in this great landslide for the Republican Party, which then carried on until 1912 when Wilson came in. But during that era of the 1890s, the Republican Party ran for office on the basis of representing national interests rather than, quote, sectional interests. In other words, they submerged any distinction between North and South because they said they represented national interests. And by so doing, it was actually a political ploy, because the South and the West was actually more populist, and they were fighting the industrial capitalism of the Republican Party that McKinley represented. But it was all submerged in the name of nationalism. But Lincoln was considered in terms of his role as the man who kept the Union together. And he was a strong president. And Theodore Roosevelt, who succeeded McKinley, prided himself on being a descendant of Lincoln, and not only as being a fellow Republican, but also in terms of being a strong president. And so Lincoln was being considered in terms of his role as keeping the Union together, and that's the image that the Lincoln Memorial projects. When you go into it, it says, the man who saved the Union. Although there is the Gettysburg Address and there is the second inaugural, the major theme is that he saved the Union. And the image of the Lincoln Memorial, of course, reflects the Parthenon in Athens. There's the Doric capitals on the outside, the Ionic capitals on the inside. We have the statue of Lincoln, comparable, analogous to the statue of Pallas Athena in Athens. I mean, there are a lot of things about it, but it is reflection of Lincoln as the savior of the Union. The states that are listed on the frieze or whatever, I don't know the Greek word for it, but it's right underneath. It's all the states of the Union, because that is the principle that it reflects. It does not reflect Lincoln as the emancipator. And indeed, the crowning glory is the bridge between the Lincoln Memorial and the Arlington Cemetery, the Lee Custis Mansion, which sort of brings together, again, the reconciliation. And during that interval, a statue was put up, actually the tallest monument in Arlington Cemetery was put up by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. It's called the New South. And it was dedicated by Woodrow Wilson, who was the son of the South. It was dedicated by Woodrow Wilson in 1914, at the very moment that he was segregating the federal workforce. So again, there was that tradition at that time of how the Union was put together, and it was put together by reconciliation and reunion between the North and the South. Now, how has this image changed? At this very moment in 1909, when this was being designed and so forth, actually it wasn't built, it wasn't open till 1922, and at that time, of course, seating was segregated. There was only one black speaker, who was a man who had been the successor of Booker T. Washington at Tuskegee Institute. And the Ku Klux Klan paraded down Pennsylvania Avenue openly. And lynching was very commonplace. So it was in that context that the Lincoln Memorial was dedicated. But in 1909, the NAACP was founded. And things began to change very slowly, but they began to change. And the big change that occurred was when Lincoln Memorial began to change its character, what it represented. When Marian Anderson in Easter 1939 sang on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, we all know that the Constitution Hall was segregated. And the story is not quite the same as it's written up, but what actually happened is she refused to sing to a segregated audience. And so the Daughters of the American DAR said, well, I'm sorry, you can't sing here because the rules are that you had to sing in front of a segregated audience. So she refused to do so. And then that became the basis for the Department of Interior, Harold Dickies and Oscar Ewing, who was a son of the South, to organize that famous concert on the steps of Lincoln Memorial. So the Lincoln Memorial began to change. We all remember Frank Capra's Mr. Deeds Comes to Washington, or some of those other movies that he did in the 1930s about someone coming to the Lincoln Memorial, to Lincoln's statue, and being innervated for American democracy and so forth. Well, in 1941, America was organizing to fight in the Second World War, and A. Philip Randolph, who had been the head of the Brotherhood of Railway Porters, had just managed to get his union recognized and belonged to the AFL, and also it was not only a labor union victory, but also a source of racial pride, that this altogether black organization and had managed to create a union victory with the Pullman Company, which of course hired more blacks than any other company in the country. So A. Philip Randolph decided to try to organize a march on Washington. And this was to be a march that would be all black. I mean, they didn't want any whites because they were afraid of being accused of communist taint, because the communists were coming in on this deal. So they said only blacks, no whites. And they got all the churches and the Elks and, you know, the usual people to come together. And it was very, very unusual, because most people felt, well, you don't want to ruffle feathers. You don't want to do too much. You don't want to be too much up front. You never know what people will think. So they, of course, Franklin Roosevelt was president. He was president, and his power rested on the Democratic Party, which was mainly Southerners in Congress. He couldn't get anything done if he didn't go along with the segregational Democrats in the Congress. So he was going to try to keep things cool. And he said, well, I don't want you to do this march. I will make some arrangements. And he issued an executive order to start what we call the Employment Practices Committee and so forth, so that people who were going to have government contracts theoretically would have to be responsive to black needs for jobs. However, there was nothing was done about the discrimination in the military. At that time, the U.S. military was thoroughly segregated, and no black could be enlisted in the Marines. So that, nothing was done about that by Roosevelt at that time. But the war came. Some things happened. As you know, Truman did issue a ruling which opened up the Navy and the other services to blacks. And then 1963, and we all know the story of the Civil Rights Movement. It sort of created a sense of it was okay, and it was consistent with being an American to be concerned about what was going on in civil rights. And so we all know the story of 200,000 people, the greatest single demonstration in American history, the inspirational speech by Martin Luther King, the very peaceful and very grand character of that integrated demonstration where people were joined together. And although Kennedy was afraid, he was trying to keep it cool too. They did a good job, and it was a well-done job, and it became an inspiration for creating, after Kennedy's death, the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and all of the Great Society activities that Lyndon Johnson deserves a lot of credit for, in my opinion. In any event, we know the story, and we know the story that now across the road from the Lincoln Memorial is that memorial to Martin Luther King. So now the streets of Washington reflect a different story. They reflect a more diverse story. They reflect the two narratives to a greater degree than before. So with all these statues of generals and all that, we have to recognize the story they're telling and that there are two stories, and how can we keep them in mind so we can reconcile them in some way or another, because they're both stories of America. And I thank you very much. Fisher.
It's too far.
Yeah, you have a good voice. I know your voice.
Mark, this is so impressive, your command of detail. I have 100 questions for you, but the one I want to put forward is, how long would it take you to get into all that detail?
Well, the question is, my good friend Fisher Howe, who's had very much experience throughout his very long and distinguished life, has asked, how did I get it all together? And it's taken my whole life, you know that. It takes your whole life to get all this stuff. I mean, when I was a kid growing up in Boston, I said, what is this story of the Civil War? Because we were taught American history every single year. We started with the conquistadores, and we ended up sometime around the Civil War, but we never really understood what was going on. And I remember I was, you know, the best student in the class, so I was asked, when were the slaves freed? And I, knowing the right answer, I said, January 1, 1863, sir. And he said, okay, you got 100 on that. But then I had this epiphany. I don't know where it came from, because, you know, we were taught to know the right answer. There was only one answer. And I said, you know, I don't think they're free yet. And this was in 1945 or whatever. And I had this epiphany that maybe the answers that we've been told to give weren't always correct. And so, of course, since I had known the right answer, I got 100. But anyone else who said what I said got a 0. Yes.
Now, there's a Saint Gaudens statue that's in the National Gallery, and he did a black regiment, I think.
Who?
Saint Gaudens.
That's the 54th statue. That's the 54th statue. That wasn't at the memorial.
No. I know what you're talking about, but who are you talking about?
Well, it's it's a replica of the one that's
in the one that's in Boston, and it's in the National Gallery. Right. It's the plaster cast that's been gilded, and it's really very beautiful. But I just forgot the name of the sculptor. You're speaking with a French accent. That's my problem.
Didn't that address that other aspect that you were talking about?
Well, that's in Boston.
No, but it's a replica.
It's a replica, but it's been put in to the National Gallery just recently. It was not on the streets of Washington. It's in the National Gallery, but it's just been regilded and put in there. But the Robert Gould Shaw Memorial has its own problems. We won't talk about that because I did do a book on Boston, which does talk about the Robert Gould Shaw Memorial on Boston Common, the 54th. Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else? Whatever. Let's hear. Yes, go on. Well, there is a map. Well, there's a map in the book of Washington in 1860. And remember, in 1860, it was before the war. And at the, before the war, the city of Washington, you all know the city of Washington was laid out by Peter L'Enfant. And it's only, it runs up to Florida Avenue. That's called Boundary Road in those days. And the city itself was not settled beyond north of H Street. The Lafayette Park was a major social center. And most of the people who lived here lived between Lafayette Park, the White House, and the Capitol. And the city itself did not fill the settled area did not fill the entire city of Washington. The city of Washington, as I said, was laid out by Peter L'Enfant and ended at Florida Avenue. The rest of the District of Columbia included Georgetown, included the county of Washington. As you know, the portion that had been in Virginia was retroceded back to Virginia. So we only have 2/3, and it was all together from Maryland. So we have Georgetown, we have the city of Washington, and we have the county of Washington, which is the rural area. Now that was all put together in 1870 to form the District of Columbia. But remember, when we talk about Washington, when we talk about Washington today, we see it as synonymous with the District of Columbia. But in those days, the city of Washington, quote unquote, is only that portion of the coastal plain that ended at Florida Avenue. Yes. Any other comments, questions? You out some?
No, I do.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. Let me just say, again, I thank you, you know, for your work, and especially for talking about the narrative that has not been told. And as a neurologist and one who has taught it at Georgetown, I wonder now that the brain is the last frontier, if you can tell us what on earth is wrong with people that they hate so much, and that the full history and narrative has never been told and been squashed, and, you know, can it be treated?
Well, I think the only way to treat anything like that is to increase the nuances of what history is about, because the lost cause told the history of Reconstruction, the Civil War. That was the way it was taught. The way I was taught in Boston, which was a, quote, center of Northern abolitionism. But in any event, as we begin to tell more and more, we can see that it was a more complex story. But when you teach kids in high school American history, it's taught like it's straight, straight, straight. Like there's only one answer, and that's what it is.
Well, I can certainly relate to what you said about the details of the Civil War. I am a generational Washingtonian, And my ancestors did come here just after, in the 1870s, just after the Civil War. And I am a descendant of people who were enslaved, you know, in Virginia on both sides.
Yeah.
And after, it wasn't until I was able to retire, even with, you know, degrees to go back. And that is all I have studied for the last 3 or 4 years. Some of us have had to do that, you know, in our older years. But there is so much that we don't know. And I was glad to see now when you go to Charleston and go to through some of those exhibits and go to the fort, that they now, you know, show the actual secession document that makes it very, very clear that the war was about slavery.
Well,
and that slavery was not only the economic engine of the South, and Charleston, you know, was its wealthiest city, you know, in those times, but it was about slavery. That is exactly what it was about. It was not just the economic engine, it was the social engine, and it was responsibility for the wealth that accumulated in the South.
Well, there's a recent book which I just saw a review on about cotton being the industrial commodity mm-hmm. of the 19th century, just as sugar in the 18th century was cotton mm-hmm. in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And oil, of course, is the 20th century.
Yeah, and you have to add to that the rice and the tobacco
yeah.
and all of the other things that, you know.
It's a very slaves. Fundamental.
That's right.
Fundamental
That's thing. Right. But thank you
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, I know your book is more about how the narratives of the Civil War are reflected on the streets of Washington, but I just wanted some context because I'm interested in the theory of the two narratives. What was the more driving force in Lincoln's decision surrounding his efforts around the Civil War? Was it that of emancipation or was it that of the reunification?
Well, he had both in mind. From the very beginning, his role was to bring about reunion. He had that as his primary role. And in order to create the victory, he felt that it was necessary to incorporate emancipation as part of the goals of that war. And there are many reasons, and we can go on about them, but the point I'm trying to make is that the two narratives really coexist. The war was won to some extent because of the enlistment of black troops. And therefore, the goal of winning the war, which was primary, was inherent in that was the emancipation. And he, whether he wanted that primary or secondary is another total different argument we can go on about. But the two narratives coexist. That's the point I think is important to know. Yes. Anyone else? Yes, go on.
I'll say no. I happen to be a volunteer at Pierce Mill. And Pierce Mill is fascinated. I thought I knew a little bit about history, but I went into the barn, which is kind of a display area, and found out, I've been told, I hadn't realized it, that in fact the Pierces had owned slaves. There were farms all the way up to Rock Creek Park
yeah.
in the county of Washington.
Right.
And there was an Emancipation Proclamation in D.C. a year before the other
That's
one.
Right.
The Pierces got paid for their slaves.
Yes, yes, yes.
$6,000, which was a huge amount of money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's blown my mind, but it makes me think the Civil War was, you know, there were still some slaves here. There was lots of freed slaves that got here, contraband. Of course, and so you had all this going on. Washington must have been really wild.
Well, I think it's very important to recognize that Washington was different because its governance was by the Congress.
Yes.
So, and I was going to talk about that, but I didn't have time. But the governance by the Congress created the Emancipation Proclamation in Washington in April 62. By so doing, there was abrogation of the Fugitive Slave Act because people could walk across from Prince George's County. Once they got into D.C., they couldn't be recognized, and that essentially abrogated the Fugitive Slave Act. So there were a lot of factors that made Washington because of its governance, different, and how it affected the emancipation story. Because not only that, but during Reconstruction, Washington being under congressional governance and the congressional people, Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner and all that, were very much in favor and of black voting rights, and voting rights came about in Washington, D.C. prior to anywhere else, and of course were taken away by Congress the same way, and we all suffered. Yeah. There were some other questions. Oh, you had a question.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow on to something you just said. You said with it was the introduction of the black troops into the Union Army that helped turn the war. Is that what you just said?
Absolutely. Well, I'm saying that was part of the way to win the war, was to, you, they needed troops. They needed men.
Yes, need the manpower.
They needed fighting men.
Yeah.
And the volunteer army was not working. They needed to draft people. The draft was very unpopular. As you know, there were draft riots in New York and elsewhere. And the recruitment of black troops, not only as auxiliaries, as helpers, but also as fighting troops. And that whole issue became, when the Emancipation Amendment, the 13th Amendment, was passed in just 150 years ago. It was passed in January of 1865. That 13th Amendment sort of confirmed what had been issued only as an executive order. The Emancipation Proclamation was only an executive order. So as you know, executive orders can be changed. So the passage of the 13th Amendment, which is the story of the movie Lincoln, is very important, because that meant that it was established within the Constitution. And Lincoln fought, as you know, by the movie. The movie is accurate in that respect, although not in all detail. But Lincoln fought very hard to get that passed, and to get it passed by a lame duck Congress, which included Democrats as well as Republicans, because he wanted that 13th Amendment to be a reflection of the country as a whole and not just a Republican thing, because he knew that the new Congress coming in had a strong Republican majority. But he wanted it passed by this lame duck Congress that included Democrats as well as Republicans. And he fought for that because he felt that the men who had fought in the Army, the colored troops, deserved to be recognized. And he was killed, actually, because he had recommended in a public address that John Wilkes Booth heard that he was going to recommend voting rights in Louisiana for men who had had a military duty. And that was part of that whole process that Lincoln fought for. I mean, he wasn't totally in favor of voting rights for blacks, but he felt for men who had fought that they deserved to be recognized. So that was part of the whole mishmash that we're talking about.
That is such an important piece of information to not only state, but to push forward to change the erroneous perception that emancipation was granted as opposed to people
earning it,
fought for it,
yes,
demanded it, etc.
Exactly, and that's why the military story is so unfair, because the blacks are excluded. When you go to any of these battles, the reenactment has no black people, because they were excluded from the military story. It's a shaking of hands across the picket's charge. That's the story of a military.
And others.
Well, Frederick Douglass was always very much aware of what the issues were. Okay.
Thank you.
Well, let me have someone else, anyone? Well, we all had chance. Okay, I'll give you.
You know, it's interesting, all these years later, we have the same narrative of Washingtonians dying in wars and us not having
equipment. That's right. Oh, I'm sorry.
Troops coming down had reached into the Bethesda, like where our tasty diner is. Silver Spring, if they had gotten about that far as well.
Yeah, they came.
I wonder if you thought there was any correlation.
With what? Well, they came. They came and they invaded. Montgomery Blair. Montgomery Blair was the Blairs owned Silver Spring. That was their property. The word Silver Spring is named after a spring on their property that had some mica in it. It looked like silver, so it's called Silver Spring. That was their property. And because Montgomery Blair had been a member of the Lincoln cabinet, and his brother had been a member of the Union Army, when they came through, they destroyed the home of the Blairs. And as you know, the name Blair is very big in Silver Spring. There's Montgomery Blair High School, there's this one, that one. So the Blair family was connected with Silver Spring, and their property was destroyed by the invading Confederates.
And they were stopped at Fort Stevens?
What? Well, they were stopped at Fort Stevens, but they came in and did a lot of damage on their way in. Yeah.
Where's Fort Stevens exactly?
Where's Fort Stevens? It's when you go out Georgia Avenue, you'll find it. There's a cemetery.
13th
and Georgia. There's a cemetery across from what was the front door of Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, or Walter Reed Army Medical Center, on Georgia Avenue. And there's a little cemetery, a tiny little cemetery that was made. If you go there on Memorial Day, you'll see the American flags lined up. It's kind of sad because it's a little tiny place and it's surrounded by apartment houses. And it's not very well tended, but it was the place where the men who fought in Fort Stevens were buried.
And there's another part of it too at Fort Stevens, right there at 13th. And that's where the African American woman who owned that property, her property, and I didn't see it in your book, but I know that's not the purpose of this, was confiscated and used by the Union as well as the military repose and the hospital, for which she was never compensated.
Well, that's the story of a lot of people. You're right. Yes, there was a question back there. Yes.
Thank you. I'm a volunteer for the Fort Stevens 150th anniversary that we celebrated in July there, and the cemetery is Battleground National Cemetery. It's one of the tiny, smallest national military cemeteries in America. It's worth a visit. But we do need volunteers if you go on. We do do the put flags up there, and it's the Civil Defenses of Washington. We are going to have another celebration in July for the 151st. But it's a great place to visit, and
it deserves to be recognized.
And you can go right to the Lincoln Cottage, which is half a mile away.
It deserves to be recognized. I think it needs to be recognized. Thank you very much for all your attention. And we have. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was playing by the rules, I guess. Guess that's why.
Go on.
I just wanted to point out and.
Shush.
Sorry, gang, if you want to leave. If you want to elaborate, but because you just did shorthand about the Emancipation Proclamation, but it's not just a coincidence that it wasn't put through till midway through the war, that Lincoln started out thinking with quite different views about how much he wanted to interfere with existing slavery. And he gradually came around to the idea of the necessity of declaring emancipation. So you might elaborate on that just a bit.
Well, I want you to understand that when Lincoln was elected, he was a moderate, quote unquote. He was a Whig in the tradition of Henry Clay. Now, Henry Clay was a slave owner, and Henry Clay was the founder of the American Colonization Society. And they thought that they, when the blacks were freed, whatever will be done, they would go back to Africa and they would not be part of the United States. But the people didn't agree with that. And so a lot of things had to change, and it had to change in Lincoln's mind as well as in other people's minds. But it's a very important story. My focus in this book has been, and all my books, is to talk about how Washington reflects the history and how history affects Washington. So that's the story, and I'm very pleased that you all had a chance to come and hear it. Thank you very much.